Now, we might just take a moment out here to think about the kind of theory that results when this notion of virtue is, as it is for Plato, and as it becomes more important, more centrally indeed for Aristotle, central to moral philosophy. The question of moral philosophy then becomes not primarily the question, what should I or shouldn't I do, but rather the question, what kind of a person should I become? The emphasis shifts from licit and illicit actions to virtues and vices, understood as states of character. States of character here may be thought of on the model of virtues that are composite and objectively determined, that is, that have to do with things that are like knives. When we speak of the virtue of a knife, for example, which has a number of different composite things, its sharpness, its heft, the way in which it keeps its edge, or single and qualitatively determined, as when we speak specifically of the virtue of sharpness in the knife. So, in other words, we might speak of the virtue of a knife or the virtue of sharpness. We may therefore find ourselves thinking either of human virtue, on the one hand, or of the virtue of temperance or patience, or any of the specific ways in which we praise one another by listing our virtues, saying, for example, that we are trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent, as all the Boy Scouts among us remember. In all of these cases, of course, the disposition, which a virtue is a disposition for proper action. So lest we lose sight of this fact, in the contemporary enthusiasm for virtue ethics, it's important to stress that the answer to the question, what kind of person should I become, always is, for Plato and Aristotle, a person properly disposed to act in certain ways under such and such circumstances. How exactly we're to negotiate the differing roles of character and action in the economy of our moral theories is a central issue with which moral philosophy has always been asked to deal. Well, in any case now, we're ready to give, I think, a more sophisticated answer to our original question, what's the relationship between justice and virtue, and one more in keeping with what we've been earlier talking about in the lectures on the Euthyphro and the Charmides. For now we're able to say that justice is a virtue, and that means simply that it's a state or quality of an entity that in some sense enables the entity to do well what it characteristically does. Well, what kind of virtue is justice? Notice that that's just the question that the Republic asks in Book 1 and asks again at the beginning of Book 2. Socrates there proposes that the answer to this question, because of the fact that justice is a general attribute, the answer to this question will be constant over several different kinds of entity to which we might ascribe it. That is, the answer to the question will be the same whether we say that an individual has the virtue of justice or whether a city has the virtue of justice. The details might be different, but the formal definition will have to be the same. And secondly, anticipating arguments such as we find much later in such figures as Locke, Hobbes, Vico, and Dewey. Secondly, that we would do well to look at justice in a political organization where it might in fact be easier to discern. Well, in light of what we've said, we can at least say now this much more. Whatever it is that we're ascribing the virtue of justice to, that is, saying about it, it's just, justice is at least one of the things that enable it to do well what its function is. And let's follow the lead of the dialogue and talk, as the participants of the dialogue do, first about the city, where this means, as I suggested, a society, commonwealth, or republic, any kind of organization of individuals that comes together with, as we say, a common weal. What is the nature of a commonwealth? Socrates suggests that we address this question by actually imagining the origin of social collectivity. And again, anticipating many later thinkers, he finds this origin in the division of labor, in the simple fact that none of us is self-sufficient. So that he reminds us that, as he says, and this is at 369. B in the dialogue, I think a city comes to be because none of us is self-sufficient, but we all need many things. That's where the foundation of a city occurs. And the argument with which he immediately follows this observation is a simple one but critical. Different folks being different, they're therefore able to do different things. And therefore, there will be better and worse divisions of labor, depending on who it is that does what.